this is We Are History Pod, and oh, John, we've got an apology to make, haven't we?
Before we even start, we're going to be saying sorry to our listeners. What a way, three series in. Is it three or four? And we
I think this is our fourth series, and we start with an apology. We're not apologising for the previous three series, let's make that clear.
Well, you know.
Well, in case.
No, sound issues, technical issues.
We have got technical issues. We could blame it on the fact that John is in New York City and I'm in Brighton, UK. However, it's just that we're old and slightly incompetent.
Well, both of us cocked up. Yours was at like 400 miles an hour on fast forward, and mine was absolute silence, which for a podcast is not what you want, to have nothing at all.
No. Luckily, though, I had press play and record. How old am I? I had press records on the Zoom.
Yes.
That we were also having at the same time. So we do have episodes. It's just that the audio quality might be a little bit ropey, by which I mean ropier than usual.
That's what you're going to hear on this week's episode, a Zoom recording. So apologies for the low quality of the podcast you're about to hear.
The audio, John, the audio of the podcast you're about to hear.
Welcome back to We Are History. It's series 27 or something.
Four, John. Series four. People will be at home going, oh, I've missed a load.
Makes it sound good. have you been, Angela?
I'm all right, John. We should say to people that we're in different continents right now. It's quite exciting, isn't it? First time we've done a transatlantic recording.
I love your little country. Yeah, you in Brighton, England. Is that right?
How long have you been there, John? A week.
But it's affected me.
In New York City on Broadway.
Yeah, if you hear sirens in the background or, you know, cabs honking, that's what it all is. I'm on the 33rd floor on 45th Street, New York, Manhattan.
Wow. So you're doing Mrs. Doubtfire the musical?
Mrs. Doubtfire the musical, yeah.
Is it back up and running now?
Well, we're in tech at the moment. This is why I can slip away to do this podcast. I should be in the theatre by rights, but I've just slipped away. And previews start on the 21st of October. So, fingers crossed that all works and that nobody gets bloody COVID or anything. So, yeah.
Because you had previews before, right? And then COVID hit before you properly got started.
Yeah, we had three previews and the thing closed down for like 30 days. And that was March 2020. So, yeah, now we're finally back after 18 months. And it's great to be back in the theatre and working with those lovely actors and just doing what we all want to do, which is just get on with our jobs.
I mean, working with actors is not as fun as working with comedians, right, John? I mean, they're a handful of actors, yeah?
Working with Angela Barnes is infinitely preferable. And you, during the holidays, dear listeners, Angela got married. What a great day that was.
I did get married and John was there. It was fun, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a great wedding. It was one of the best weddings I've ever been to, if I'm honest. No, seriously, it was so warm-hearted and such a great atmosphere. And just, you thought of everything. She got me this little nameplate and on it were little badges. Everyone had the individual badges for their name cards. And it was like the Labour Party. It was narrow boats. It was acting. It was a theatre comedy. It was all the things at Fulham. She had all my personality traits or my interests on little enamel badges. So, yeah, it was very touching. All the thought you put into it.
We were so lucky. It was a beautiful sunny day and we were out in this lovely field in the countryside. It was a lot of work, but it was worth it.
And lots of draft bitter based on our podcast.
Exactly. No wine on the table, was there, John?
It was all beer. Draft beer is fantastic. And, Angela came in an open top, what is it, 125?
Fiat 500.
Fiat 500.
1963 Fiat 500.
Yeah, waving. It's brilliant. And great choir as well. I forgot to mention you how lovely that choir was. I've been playing that elbow track ever since.
Do you know what's really, the one thing I didn't plan very well is, of course, I missed the choir.
Yeah, of course you did.
Because they sang while I keep calling the congregation the audience. They're not an audience, they're the guests. Yeah. But they sang as the guests were coming in and then they sang outside when we were doing photos. But of course I missed it all.
Yeah.
And everyone kept saying to me, oh, they did that elbow song and it was amazing. I was like, I missed it completely.
Get them to come and do it for your birthday or something. But it was a great day. We've had a great summer. We're glad to be back.
Yes, awesome. Autumn now, it's cold, miserable.
Good reason to choose this week's subject. What have you got for us this week, Angela?
Well, John, you may have forgotten since you've been in America for a fortnight now, but over here, we've gone a bit mad with a petrol shortage that isn't really a petrol shortage, but there is a petrol shortage. Whenever there's a fuel crisis or shortages or anything in this country now, people go, oh, we're going to have another winter of discontent.
And Angela talked to me about doing the winter of discontent. And she said to me, is that the same thing as the three-day week? Now, well, someone who's old enough to remember both of them. I was going, no, three-day week actually was worse. That was the Tories. Yeah. Winter discontent has a better brand. That's
well,
like
this
more
is
famous.
The interesting thing about it, isn't it? Because the whole sort of strife of the 70s gets conflated into one big event that lasted a decade, when actually it was under two different governments.
People sort of just think, oh, yeah, it was terrible under the winter of discontent when the miners went on strike. And it's like, no, that wasn't the same thing. So we're going to unpick it all today. And
we are indeed.
Explain it all. There's going to be a Winter of Discontent board game you can play. There's a whole new app you can download, a Winter of Discontent app. And we'll be sending out merchandise. It's going to be a whole industry we're setting up.
In the Winter of Discontent was 1978 to 79. So
yes,
I was
gone,
alive.
Like a fetus or something.
I was alive, John, but I was, well, what would I have been? Two going on? No, three. I would have turned two in November 78. So I was a little toddler.
Little Barnsley.
Yeah. Whereas, were you a student then?
No, I was at school. I wasn't old enough to vote. I remember we used to have these discussions, rather formal discussions, where the head of sixth form would get us all to sit around in the common room and talk about issues of the day. And I remember this boy that used to really annoy me set it off with, "Sir, what do you think about the unions bringing the country to its knees?" And I was like, John O'Farrell, were you going to defend this? You're the only Labour man in the whole sixth form. And so I had to sort of defend, well, I mean, you know, it's probably a bit much that, you know, they're not being able to bury the dead. But I mean, you know, you've got to think about it from the other point of view. So that was me in 78.
Posh little John, champion of the unions.
Exactly. That's always how they called me. And 79, there was in the election, which we'll get to. I stood for Labour in that school. Got 30 votes. 30 votes out of a possible 1,300.
To be fair, you were at school in Maidenhead.
Where I went and stood. I went back to the school when I stood for Parliament proper there. I said, you only stand for Parliament in Maidenhead twice, once on the way up and once on the way down. It's great to be back.
And of course, people can read about that in your book, Things Can Only Get Worse.
Things Can Only Get Better, actually, being that one, the first one.
Oh, is it the first one, is it, when you stood for?
Yeah, 79 to 97, yeah. But good, thanks for plugging both books. That's good work, yeah. Angela's going to lead on this one. Haven't read a book about it. I've read a book about it as well, actually.
I mean, the book I've read is Crisis What Crisis by John Shepherd, but there's lots of stuff out there about it. And like I say, I wasn't around. So obviously, John, you'll have memories of it that I don't have.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was around, but not around. But I think it's quite interesting, the sort of situation with the unions in the 70s, because union membership was suddenly higher than it had ever been, because you had, well, for a start, you had women in the workforce more than you'd had before. So a lot of the increase in union membership was women returning to work or entering the workforce. And apparently 73% of women who started work in the 70s joined a union, as opposed to 19-20% of men who started
That's
work in the 70s.
Yeah. But those jobs that women were doing tended to be in those sort of public sector jobs, like the health service, and where the crisis came in this winter. So they were quite involved in some of those strikes.
And you also had a lot more people from minority ethnic groups joining unions at that point. 61% of black male workers were unionised, but only 47% of white male workers.
There'd been something a little earlier in the decade called the Grunwick strike. Mm. I don't know if you've got that in your notes at all, but the Grunwick strike.
That's the Ugandan women, isn't it?
Well, there were
Ugandan Asian. That had been expelled by Idi Amin,
But they were working in a photo processing lab and were really exploited. And their strike was quite a major event on the news. And they had people going down there and supporting them. Even Shirley Williams went down and joined the picket line. Then things got ugly when all the men started turning up and joining the picket line. There were police violence. But it was the first time that the British public became aware of women of colour leading a strike and being on the news every night and talking very articulately about how they're being exploited and how their wages are being pushed down and made work longer hours. And it was sort of inspiration, I think, for a lot of women of colour, you know, in the health service to sort of become more unionised.
So if we go back to the beginning of the decade quickly, I'm not going to go back to the Big Bang, John, but I think it's important that we do make this differentiation between what happened under Edward Heath at the beginning and then under Wilson and Callahan.
It starts with long hair. It starts with long hair in the 70s, ends with short hair. That's what you need to think. Big collars, then small collars.
It starts with the Beatles, ends with no Beatles.
Yeah, exactly. It ends with the beginning of the 70s, of course, is when the Beatles split up. But it starts with sort of glam rock, ends with punk, and ends with sort of the Human League. Someone like me, my hair would have been cut off very gradually over sort of 12 or 18 reforming months. None of this blunt scissors with crazy color and so on. Like, damn with society. I was like, well, we're cutting the hair back gradually. None of this thing.
Well, John, I'm looking at you now on Zoom. It looks like you went a bit far.
I did. Well, it's so long in the early 70s. It wore out the roots. That's why I'm bald now. The fringe couldn't take the weight. Sorry, Angela, you were saying about
No, that's quite all right. So by the early 70s, we'd had a Wilson government, and then we have Edward Heath.
Yeah.
And a Tory government, obviously. And I think it's important to sort of talk about the post-war consensus at this point.
Yes.
So since the end of World War II and until the 1970s, really, and we're going to sort of talk about how the consensus fell apart, there's sort of this debate about whether or not it really was a consensus or what it was. But it was where...
Butskillism was the phrase.
Butskillism. So that's Rab Butler from the Tories and Hugh Gaitskill from the Labour Party. Yeah. And they sort of worked together on an economic plan, very much based in sort of Keynesian economics, right?
Yeah.
So the idea being, I'm really bad at economics, John, so I'm going to keep this real light.
This was in old money, so it was even harder.
Exactly.
I mean, I wonder if they said, how many shillings in a pound? That's insane. Yeah.
But basically, it's spending your way out of a recession.
Investing in public works and all that.
Exactly. So increased inflation, you increase public spending, etc. Yeah. So inflation and recession were these sort of mutually exclusive things under that idea. But then things started in the 70s to not go the way that economists predicted. So you end up with this situation as inflation rose in Britain in the 60s and 70s, something they called stagflation happened.
Stagflation.
That's which is stagnation and inflation. So suddenly you had poor economic growth coupled with high inflation. And that, you know, there could be lots of causes for that, but it sort of went against these Keynesian theories, really.
Yeah.
So throughout the 70s, inflation was, I mean, it got to its highest. I think it was in 1975, it got to 20-something%.
Yes, and that's for other international reasons, which I'm sure you're going to come on to.
We will indeed. But it was double figures through a lot of this period.
Yeah, yeah. And that meant, you know, that had a big impact on ordinary people. You put your savings away and suddenly they weren't worth as much as they were when you put them away. You go to buy a loaf of bread and it had gone up significantly during the week. We've never lived with the raging inflation in our lifetimes, really.
No, not to that extent, have we, where it makes that much difference, really.
You feel it when you go in shop, you know.
Yeah. I think it's quite interesting because you're at a time where people are being sold, you know, you can have foreign holidays now. You can have a washing machine. You can have a colour television. You know, all these things that 20 years before they didn't have. But then, you know, working people suddenly couldn't afford those things that they've been promised that were going to be in their lives. So they really felt it.
And there had been decades of improving standards of living. It's what the French call les 30 glorieuses, the 30 glorious years from the war to the 70s, where standards of living were improving and people were sort of finding that they were better off than their parents. And we thought that was going to be in a continual trajectory. So sorry, kids, about that flat you wanted to buy. But
exactly. Ask any people under 30 now and they'll tell you that's not how it works anymore, as we know.
Yeah.
So Edward Heath's government implements something called the Industrial Relations Act in 1971, which is the sort of first attempt by the Tory government really to try and weaken the economic power of trade unions.
Yes.
Trade unions obviously have collective bargaining. They can bargain for their pay increases every year to be in line with inflation, etc.
Yeah.
But with this high inflation, it was really in the interest of the economy to sort of cap that somewhat.
Yes, that was like the dominant sort of political narrative at the time, is that we can't put up pay 15% if we're going to bring inflation down. It's like, and then the workers going, yeah, but the cost of our loaf of bread has gone up 25%. We need to be paid more so we can continue to be able to afford our kids and, you know, and pay our mortgage or pay our rent, more likely back then. So it was one of those things where the authorities and the powers that be, the government and employers, were, you know, using this stick with which to hold down wages. And it's very interesting hearing different perspectives on it, and some of those in the book I read about what it was like to be at the sharp end of that.
So you get a situation where by January 1972, unemployment's at 2 million, which is the highest it's been in over two decades.
Yeah.
Trade unions respond to that with pretty much a full-scale counterattack on this government that's completely hobbled by inflation and this high unemployment.
This is the Heath government, yeah? The Heath government, 70 to 74.
So in 72 and 74, there were these two miners' strikes. Now, I think these are what often get conflated with the Winter of Discontent, which was much later, because these miners' strikes, particularly the latter one, 1974, was what led to the three-day week.
Yes, along with the petrol situation. Yeah.
Yeah, so the petrol, there was also a fuel crisis there, because in 1973, I think it was, OPEC, which is the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, they suddenly hiked their oil prices in retaliation for US support for Israel in the Yom Kippur War. So suddenly, Britain and Europe and America have these hugely inflated oil prices.
This was a massive deal.
Shock to the economy.
This was massive. They've quadrupled the price overnight. So this really sent shockwaves across the world, because we'd always taken cheap fuel for granted. And suddenly Saudi Arabia, leading this, realized that they had an enormous amount of power. And why were they going to put up with America doing whatever they wanted? So suddenly the shortage of fuel. I remember the garage at the end of our road ringing up my dad and saying, the tanker's coming, you can come and get some petrol. It was like they knew the phone numbers of their customers and rang us up to get some petrol.
If I wish it was like that at the moment, because I am queuing in Asda for 2 hours the other night fill up.
It's terrible. Maybe they did actually issue rationing cards in the 70s for fuel. They never actually were deployed, but they printed them all up. I remember seeing a thing on John Craven's News Round about the Western Isles, where everybody was Mac something. And they went, oh, this doing this in, you know, an order of you do the A's to G's on the first day. But that's nobody, you know, anyone M, entire population of the island. This isn't going
to
work.
Back to 1974. So there is a general election in February 1974. So by this point, we've had the three-day week, you know, Heath's government. Let's really reinforce that. It wasn't the Winter of Discontent. It was a three-day week, Heath's government, miners' strike.
Yeah, so three-day week. Just to, can I say a bit about that, Angela?
Yeah, go on, yeah.
Very easy to shoplift in Smith's. So candles on the trolleys, candles all over the shops. You'd be listening to a record in your bedroom and the power would just go out. It would go... telly would pop off. So just all the lights would go out. My next door neighbour had a candle business and they were booming.
I bet. And I could remember even in the early 80s when I was sort of maybe six or seven, my nan still had drawers full of candles that were left over from the three-day week.
Yeah. And so the three-day week means what it was. There was your job, place of work, you know, you 3 days out of five, you went into work. The other 2 days you didn't, to save fuel. It's hard to imagine the government sort of suggesting such a thing now. Heath had like five states of emergency during his brief 4 years as prime minister. It was quite a sense of swinging from one chaotic crisis to the next. And for my money, the three-day week was a much bigger crisis than the Winter of Discontent. In terms of feeling it on the ground, lights going out, no petrol, you were supposed to have an inch of bath water. There was they to tell you how much bath water you should have. Don't use all that hot water. You were supposed to put the heating off. Television ended at 10:30. I mean, there's only three channels anyway, and the TV was pretty crap. But it's like, there's nothing to watch.
And one of them was showing the TUC Congress.
No, it's like, oh, great. It's a open university. So
we'll come on to later the sort of justice of Callaghan's government kind of ending up getting the blame for a lot of
quite. That's what I feel. I think that people think of it all as the same thing.
Yeah.
And, it was great. There were two separate crises, and I rep for my money, the one under Heath was far worse. I mean, it's not his fault that OPEC, you know, had quadrupled prices. No. The miners' strike was his fault. But
and also it was a lot longer time that it went on, you know, and we'll come to this as well. But the Winter of Discontent lasted 6 weeks. I think in people's heads, there was an interview with John Lydon.
Yeah, Sex Pistols was a documentary.
Sex Pistols was a documentary in the year 2000. And they were talking about the 70s. And he was like saying, you know, there are power cuts that went out on for the whole decade, went on for years. It's like, it didn't.
And it's like rubbish
that's
was in the streets.
That's what people have remembered, you know.
Rubbish in the streets.
Rubbish piled up
on
the streets for, exactly.
And I think this throws a very interesting light on how history is remembered and how myths are constructed. Lots of people will see documentaries about the Winter of Discontent over and over again, or they'll see clips of it and on programs, and they'll think that's what they remember. So I did a documentary about the 1970 World Cup, and they said to me, you know, we talk about it being the first World Cup in color and how amazing that was. And I watched it back, and all these people were going, it was so amazing to see those Brazilian shirts in gold. And I said, no, we were all had black and white tellies then. We didn't see it in color. We've seen it in color since, and we think that's what we remember. But we all watched that World Cup in black and white. But over all these other sort of talking heads like with me, we're going, and just the blue of the Italian shirts and the gold, it's so amazing. It's like, that you've remembered that since. You've invented those memories. And the same with the Winter of Discontent, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like when you look at photos from the past, and sometimes I think, do I remember something happening, or do I just remember a photograph of something happening?
Exactly. That's how this has been reimagined,
and,
I think.
And it's been reimagined, you know, well, we'll come on again to the role of the media in how it's been sort of, because it hasn't done any harm to the Tories for people misremembering.
No quite. Past, well, they sort of helped construct the myth. But yeah, so we get to the general election of 1974.
There's a general election. Ted Heath campaigns under the slogan, "Who governs Britain?" To which the country responds, "Not you, mate." No party won a majority. Heath tried to negotiate with Jeremy Thorpe, the then Liberal leader. You can hear our podcast about him.
Yeah.
That wasn't successful. And so he ends up resigning in March 1974. And Harold Wilson is back as head of a minority Labour government. They managed to repeal this Industrial Relations Act, which Heath had brought in to try and sort of temper the unions. They repealed that and they brought in instead the 1974 Health and Safety at Work Act.
Yeah, and they ended the miners' strike, crucially. They sort of paid the miners what they were asking for because everyone felt they deserved it, actually. And so that was a big change. So Thatcher was like, oh, you don't give in to the unions. But then we have this sort of these few years of, you know, a return to what Thatcher used to call beer and sandwiches at number 10. It was like union leaders coming to Downing Street and talking about, you know, pay restraint and trying to set that in a partnership with the representation of the representatives of working people, which seems reasonable to me. But that was like, oh, beer and sandwiches at number 10. Sounds quite nice, actually.
Yeah, so I'd be up for beer and sandwiches at number 10. Well, not in current number 10, I wouldn't. No. But so Wilson's back in. We've got Dennis Healy is the Chancellor.
Yep.
And they really need to now tackle this problem of inflation, because by 1975, inflation is at 26%.
Yes.
Which is high, John. It's real high.
26% is high, yeah.
Now, previously, in the previous Wilson administration, in the 60s, Barbara Castle had presented a white paper called In Place of Strife, which was also sort of trying to change the role of the unions, you know, so that the unions would have to have a ballot before striking and things like that, to try and sort of change that power. Because the power of the unions meant that it was very difficult for the governments to bring inflation down.
Yeah. So
while they were bargaining for higher.
While there was a Labour government, there was a sort of a constructive attempt to sort of, you know, have a framework under which strikes happened, you know, agreed with the Labour thing. Or do we reject that completely and lose power and let Mrs. Thatcher sort of do that? And destroy the unions completely. So that's basically what happened over those 15 years between In Place of Strife and the miners' strike. It was like, they're looking back in 84 going, do you know what? That looks quite attractive now.
Yeah,
what,
actually, I wish we'd, I see, yes.
Yeah. So there's a thing called the social contract, wasn't there?
Yeah, so this is Wilson sort of negotiates this contract with the Trade Union Congress to implement a voluntary incomes policy. So he's repealed the Industrial Relations Act, which, you know, the unions were pleased with, but they still needed to bring down inflation. And the union leaders did understand that, you know, you can't just have rampant inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
So together they negotiate this policy, which was called the social contract. And it was a phased policy whereby wage and price controls would be set and agreed by the government with the union leaders. And so the idea was to sort of establish wages and prices below a free market level so you could bring inflation down.
Right.
And the government was set these limits to the pay rises. So phase one of this pay policy was announced in 1975 in July, and the white paper was called The Attack on Inflation. And it proposed a limit on wage rises of £6 a week for everyone earning below £8,500 annually.
Right.
So the unions sort of agreed to this, and it was a measure that they accepted because they knew that this was a phased contract, there would be three or four phases and then a return to collective bargaining. So it was the unions doing their bit to help the government bring down inflation with the understanding that eventually they would go back to collective bargaining and, you
know. Love that collective bargaining.
Love a bit of collective bargaining.
So Wilson is the Prime Minister, but at this point, he brings in a little rule that retired prime ministers should have a car, their own car for life. And his drivers in the driving pool go, why is he doing that then? Why is Wilson suddenly thinking about when he's retired, he'll have a car for the rest of his life? What happens, Angela?
Well, John, we get to 1976. And to be fair, this social contract is working, right? Recession ended. We're in economic recovery. Things are looking good. Inflation's coming down. And in fact, by 1978, it'll be back in single figures. But in 1976, in March, Wilson, shock, resigns.
Remember that day at school? Remember?
Really?
I remember the Tory being really chuffed and me going, well, it doesn't mean anything, doesn't mean anything.
Well, there's lots of theories, aren't there, as to why he resigned? Because they think it may be that he started exhibiting signs of Alzheimer's, which he later went on to develop, or colon cancer, which he also went on to develop. And I think there's an episode to be had about his resignation, because it was quite the whole lavender list thing.
Yeah, we
quite
keep promising these episodes, Angela.
I know. Like, one day we'll do that. One day. Well, this is an infamous podcast.
We must have you for dinner.
So it's fine.
It's like people you say, I must have you for dinner. I'm not going to have you for dinner.
We're never going to talk about the lavender list. But anyway, go and Google lavender list. Read about it.
Google,
it's fine.
Yeah. New Prime Minister.
Wilson resigns. We get a new Prime Minister.
Who is it? Tell me.
Farmer Jim. Farmer Jim. James Callaghan wins the leadership contest and he becomes...
A new voice for Mike Yarwood to do. Mike Yarwood, the impressionist show. Callaghan, of course, was the only prime minister to hold the four great offices of state.
Yes, he was. Chancellor, Foreign Secretary, PM, and down a street cat. Home Secretary. Yes, he's the only person still to have held all four offices, isn't he, I think? Yes.
Yes, that's right, yes. He started out on the left of the Labour Party, didn't he? Gradually moved towards the right of the party.
He was known as the keeper of the cloth cap because his relations with the unions were good. In 1976, there is a sterling crisis. By June, the pound reaches a record low against the dollar. And long story short, Dennis Healey, who's the Chancellor, he opts to get an IMF International Monetary Fund loan to the tune of $3.9 billion in order to sort of reset the economy, in order to strengthen the pound. Now, parts of the conditions of the loan were quite heavy cuts on public expenditure.
It was sort of a right-wing agenda, wasn't it? Forced onto the country, really, by international bankers. Yeah.
Well, this is the sort of, you know, turning point. Obviously, Margaret Thatcher gets the credit, for want of a better word, for bringing in that sort of monetarist Milton Friedman
way of running.
But this is actually the beginning. This is the first sort of type where Callaghan comes out and says, and in fact, I've got a quote. He says, this is in 76. He says, we used to think you could spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candor, that option no longer exists. And that insofar as it ever did exist, it only worked by injecting a bigger dose of inflation into the system.
So that was Angela, that's not as good an impression as Mike Yarwood. I really, you know.
Maybe if I'd done it in a song, it would have been better.
Yeah. But very interesting, yeah. So he's basically dissing the bloody Keynesian economic policies of the previous 30 years.
Absolutely. And this sudden sort of move to monetarist policies. Tony Benn, of course, is at this point in the cabinet. He's energy secretary, I think, at this point. And he very much favoured a different approach to the economic situation. He favoured a protectionist sort of siege economy stance, including, surprise, surprise, the reversal of the decision to join the European Common Market. We did an episode about it. Callaghan ploughs ahead with this policy, and this is where the social contract that we talked about before between the trade unions and the government starts to fall apart a little bit. They'd gone through phase one, two and three of the social contract, whereby pay increases were significantly less than the rate of inflation. And the unions agreed to that with the idea that phase four would be a return to collective bargaining. Now, when phase four actually came, because of the situation they were in, instead of a phased return to collective bargaining, what actually happened was a government it sort of enforced this 5% pay limit.
Yeah, now 5% was a shockingly low figure. Barbara Castle was appalled by it because people were struggling and inflation was still way above that. So that was basically like really squeezing the poorest in society. And it was quite a shocking, draconian limit to have set. Are we coming up to the autumn of 78 now?
We are, yeah. So in July, the TUC vote to reject this limit and insist on this return to collective bargaining. So there's tension now between the unions and the government. It is increasing.
And now we come to, I think, a fork in the road of British politics. Angela, if you don't mind me saying so.
I think we do, John. It might be a good point to take a break, actually. That might be. Maybe that's good.
Maybe people excited. Because if we take another fork at that road.
We have a little cliffhanger now. What happens next, John?
1978. It's 4 years since the last general election. Hello and welcome back to part two of We Are History. You probably heard like one ad or something.
I hope it wasn't for something horrible. I hope it was something
make your life better. We didn't like. Yes,
we did. That's true. We stopped one of them, John. We don't know what they're using now. So, you know, let's not say, anyway. No, now it's all things we like. And then we find out it's for
mining
I don't know.
In the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah, exactly.
start a gold mine in the Amazon rainforest. Partnership with We Are History. Yeah. We are talking about the winter of discontent. No, we had a little break. I've got myself a cup of tea here. I brought my tea bags from England.
And, you're so English, John.
Yeah. Well, the American tea bags are like Lipton's sort of watery things. They're horrible.
Have you got a kettle there? Because it's hard to find a kettle, isn't it? Oh, that's good. Kettle, is that on your rider?
It's my own mug. Brilliant. Look, brought my mug from England because they've got pity little thimbles. Marmite. I brought my Marmite as well. And whiskey, that's the other thing. I bought some whiskey. Went to see the Bond film last night, and my two American friends had pints, gallons of Coke. And I just said, can I have a little cup with some ice in it, please? And they gave me that for nothing. I got out my hip flask, poured my whiskey in, made the film go past much more.
You're such a Brit abroad. I love it.
Yeah, it was great. So
we are in the autumn sort of, just coming out of the summer 1978. And of course, what we're expecting, 4 years since the last general election. And of course, Callaghan hasn't got a mandate because he replaced Harold Wilson. So presumably,
everyone thinks there's going to be a general election.
Presumably, there's going to be a general election. And Labour everyone, ahead. Including Labour, well, there's a little bit of debate about this, isn't there, about how far ahead Labour were in the polls and whether they really, so I think some polls, they were 5 points ahead at this point. But in others, it looked like there could have been a hung parliament. In others, polls show the Tories with a slight lead. So it was sort of an all to play for election at this point.
We'd had two inconclusive elections already. It wouldn't have been the end of the world if it had been a narrow win. We got to fever pitch. I remember it really clearly. The whole country was going, there's going to be an election. He's going to call it. And he goes on telly. And we all sat down. And there's sort of your national leader addressing the nation on television was more of a thing back then. And whilst he was talking, we thought, this is going to announce the general election. And he went, would an election help the economy? Would an election solve the economic crisis? And we were going, oh, no, he's not going to call one. And then and then it was just like into the unknown. Mrs. Thatcher was not a popular politician at this point. She was like, most people thought she was ghastly and strident. And there was a lot of sense around that you couldn't have a woman prime minister. You know, Labour, he was more popular than her. Labour slightly ahead in the polls. And if he had called that election then, Angela, I think history could have been very different. Thatcher wouldn't have had a second bite. The Tories wouldn't have let her fight another election. She would have been out. It might have been a narrow Tory victory. I don't know.
There's some analyses say it would have been a narrow Tory victory. But, I mean, we don't know. In some parallel universe, that's exactly what happened. But
The upside is that I got a book out of it. So, you know, it's 18 years of Tory rule brought misery and hardship for everyone. But I got a book out of it. So let's look on the positive side.
But, people did just assume it was a general election. And also because of the relationship with the trade unions starting to fray at that point with this 5% pay limit, the union leaders, so he had a dinner, didn't he? A sort of private dinner with lots of union leaders who basically said to him, if you don't have the general election now in October 78, we can't guarantee that the unions won't strike over the winter because of this pay limit.
Our members won't. What we say. Yeah,
exactly.
We should say that back in those days, these union leaders were celebrities. Everyone knew who Vic Feather was, who Ron Todd was, who Jenkins, the head of the post office union, was. They were on television. Mike Yarwood used to do these guys as well. And they'd always be interviewed on the news and they'd say, well, I've spoken with my executive committee and we cannot agree to a free collective bargaining. And you'd get. It's like then you say, oh, that's Mike Yarwood's doing a brilliant Mike McCarthy. Can you name any union leaders?
I'd struggle to name any union leaders. No, I really
different
would.
Times. Different times.
Different times. Callaghan says that there's going to be no election until the spring, and that this pay policy, this 5% pay policy, is going to continue till then, which obviously went down really well with the unions.
Can I just say, Angela, from reading Tony Benn's diaries of the time, Benn's conclusion was that Callaghan was just enjoying being prime minister. And it was like, I don't want to stop being prime minister. And if I have an election, I might. And it's it's great going to see the Queen and going on all these foreign visits and stuff. And I don't want that to stop. And that was his overriding motivation. Which,
Callaghan did enjoy all the sort of statesman stuff. He was good friends with Schmidt and with Gerald Ford, He had a really...
Angela, talking of Ford... What happened?
Oh, see what you did.
Applause for that segue. Come on.
This is gold. So this is a catalyst for what is about to happen for the winter discontent. It all sort of starts at the Ford factory. So Ford, obviously, private sector, but although this wasn't a sort of official guideline, the pay rise set by Ford was sort of seen as a benchmark for negotiations throughout the whole private sector. So Ford would set their pay rise for the year and the rest of the private sector would tend to sort of
cars and manufacturing.
Yeah. So in 1978, Ford had a good year, right? So they could have afforded to pay its workers quite a large pay rise.
Ford Capri, my mum had one.
Yeah.
Ford Capri, Ford Escort,
lovely. But because it was a government contractor, Ford, they needed to sort of toe the line a bit with the government and their 5% pay cap.
Yep.
So that's what they did. They limited their pay offer to this 5% that the government had set. And of course, the workers, the Ford workers, 15,000 Ford workers, most of them from the Transport General Workers Union, went, I don't think so. You've had these massive profits and we want our cut. So in September 1978, they began an unofficial strike, which then became an official TGWU action on the 5th of October, 78. And this grew to 57,000 participants. Right. Ford then have to sort of weigh up the consequences of this strike against the government sanctions that they could face if they gave a higher pay offer. So the government had said when setting this 5% pay increase, that anyone making offers above that would be sanctioned.
Oh, you're going to be in trouble.
Right? So they're going to be told off on the naughty step.
Told off by Farmer Jim.
Exactly. So Ford sort of think about that and then they think, well, I think we're more scared of our workers not working than we are of whatever the government's going to do. So they then revised their pay offer to 17%, which the workers accepted.
17 is a bit above the 5% limit, isn't it?
Just a tad above the 5% pay limit. So the government then, Jim Callaghan, then gets all angry and goes, right, well, we told you what would happen, so we're going to impose sanctions on Ford, along with 220 other companies that had done a similar thing.
It's a lot. I mean, I would say that car strikes were such another thing of the 70s. It's like, when Basil Fawlty takes the newspaper into one of his guests, morning, Major, another car strike. I don't know why we bother, It was like car strikes at Chrysler and at British Leyland. It was just like weekly news. And then there'd be another union leader and signs of men standing around braziers, on picket lines. It was just a constant sort of feature. And this was the narrative of the news that was building up.
The government said, right, we're going to impose these sanctions. But what actually happened was the Conservatives put down a motion in the House of Commons to revoke the sanctions, which initially passed. Callaghan put down an amendment. The government eventually won by 10 votes, but it was too narrow a victory for them actually to impose any sanctions. Right. So suddenly the government, any power they had against businesses sort of upping this pay offer, gone, because they couldn't implement any of the sanctions that they'd warned them that they would. So that, of course, sends out the message across the private sector, certainly.
Yeah.
You could basically do what you like, this 5% pay cap. They can't do anything if you go exceed it.
So the government lost its authority, really, and it lost the partnership with the unions that had been the sort of appeal of a Labour government, really, to say that we can negotiate with these guys, you Tories can't, but that is sort of blown apart by this.
Yeah, absolutely. So now you've got a situation. Oh, it's worth mentioning as well, November comes, cold weather hits, like properly. Do you remember it, John? Do you remember that winter?
Oh, terrible. I don't actually. But yeah, no, I think I do. I think I've had that. I had a little moped then because I was 16, 17 and going to school on my moped and the trying to go down this hill that was just pack ice and just sliding all over God. The place, and the moped ending up on its side and me looking a bit embarrassed in front of all these younger school kids. But yeah, it was very cold, and that was it was like third coldest of the century, apparently. And
it was
heating bills and all this, it added up to people's sense of crisis.
Once these strikes start, that's when the media starts going, oh, well, you know what will happen, like it has here with the fuel and food shortages. We kept getting told were going to happen before they did. And then, of course, they become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Sugar was one. My mum, there was going to be a sugar crisis. My mum filled up the whole cupboard where the vacuum cleaner was kept in our house was full of bags of sugar because there might be a sugar shortage. Yeah. It's like, of course, is it because people like my mum stacking.
Filled up. And it's what's happened with the petrol. It's what happened with flour last year. It's what, you know, the minute you say there might be a shortage of something, everyone goes out and buys it. On that note, there is a shortage of tour tickets for my show next year.
There's going to be a We Are History podcast shortage, just telling you.
So these strikes start happening. We have a BBC technician strike, happens in November. That one gets resolved because they threatened that the Christmas Day coverage of the BBC wouldn't happen, John. Funnily enough, the BBC again went, oh, okay, maybe we will off to 15% if there's going to be no Mike Yarwood on Christmas Day. And then the big one, really, that really sort of started the panic off was the lorry driver strike. So now the government doesn't have any way to enforce its pay policies. All the unions that haven't put in their pay claims yet start thinking it's a free-for-all. Well, this is brilliant. We can do what we like now. We can ask for whatever we like. So the Transport General Workers Union, they begin demanding rises of 40% for lorry drivers in mid-December. Okay. Now, to be fair, like the haulage industry had expanded massively in this period and employers were short of drivers. Is this ringing any bells, John?
Yeah.
They're short of drivers. So the drivers they do have are working 70 to 80 hour weeks for minimal pay. Remember, their pay rises for the last 6 years have been way below inflation.
So lorry drivers indicated that they might strike, which was the first time they indicated they might be doing anything.
Hey. So the Road Haulage Association, the sort of industry trade group, they told the government they were going to keep their pay offer below 5%. But when they saw what was going on, they ended up offering 13%, right? Which is obviously still way below the 40% the unions are asking for.
Yeah.
So the workers, emboldened by what they've seen at Ford, and also there'd previously been a haulier strike in Wales, and they saw a settlement there of 20%. So they decide, no, we're not settling for 13%. We're going out on strike.
Falling apart, it seems, now, this policy.
Absolutely. So, and of course, 80% of goods are transported by road. So this is a massive problem for the government in the winter. You've already got road closures and things because of snow and ice and other problems. Oil tanker drivers were still working at this point. But what they would do is they would let the striking lorry drivers know where they were going with their oil tankers so that they could send fly pickets to stop them getting to their destinations. So they were all sort of, you know, officially working, but still part of the strike. And at this point now, the government starts to debate whether to declare a state of emergency. Margaret Thatcher's pushing for it because it's going to suit her agenda, obviously, if there's a state of emergency under a Labour government, despite there having been five under Heath's government, but no one's talking about that. Operation Drumstick was conceived. Army were put on standby to drive tankers. Again, bells ringing.
Yeah.
And at that point, though, they couldn't put the army on oil tankers until a state of emergency was declared, because only then could they allow the conscription of the assets of the oil companies.
I see.
If there's a state of emergency. Yeah. So the government did shrink away from doing for full state of emergency and for implementing that. But the structures were all in place. And it was, of course, Tony Benn was energy secretary. So he was sort of implementing that whole operation. And while it's all going on, the media are having a field day, right? Particularly the right-wing media, obviously.
Yeah, the Sun had switched sides in 78. So this was about the time that the Sun switched to being from being a Labour paper to a Tory paper.
Yeah.
There was no internet, of course. You found out stuff from reading the newspaper, and the TV news took its lead from what the newspapers were reporting. So the agenda was a generally right-wing one, as is now.
Yeah. Right? So you had headlines that sort of likened the situation to a siege, to the Battle of Stalingrad. I mean, it's absolute mad. And of course, all these fears of food supplies being cut did fuel panic buying. People were panic buying. Like you said, your mum was filling the understairs cupboard with sugar. And it was only when the drivers returned to work, which was only a couple of weeks later. You know, people think this went on for the whole of 1979. It didn't. It went on for a few weeks at the beginning of 79. And of course, when all the drivers went to work, people realised that there weren't any shortages and they now had a cupboard full of sugar to eat. You know, and The Economist reported that all these predicted shortages of food just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, one, it was Douglas Smith of the Employment Department recalled years later that only certain breakfast cereals were actually out of stock. So Callahan was attending a summit in Guadeloupe, lovely Guadeloupe, the Caribbean. So it was him, Jimmy Carter, Helmut Schmidt, and the French president, Giscard d'Estaing. There's quite a lot else going on in the world at this point. So you've got the situation in Iran in 1979 with the fall of the Shah. And then you've got
SALT II.
So we did a podcast about that. The strategic arms limitation talks were taking place to try and sort of negotiate with the Soviet Union about
the point is sunny. No one cares about
the point
that.
Is it's sunny,
sunny in Guadeloupe.
So they are, you know, while they're talking about this important stuff, they are doing a little bit of swimming and a little bit of sunbathing and a little bit of drinking cocktails. And then he sort of nail in his coffin was, rather than flying straight back from Guadeloupe, he took a few days holiday in Barbados. And a Daily Mail, they photograph him in his budgie smugglers in Barbados.
I think that's a bit unfair, but
So, well, but bear in mind, I think, you know, people back home, not only are these strikes going on and there's panic and there's right wing media sort of whipping up the panic, it's also really cold. Coldest winter, third coldest winter of the decade. And it's snow and ice and everything. So when Callahan returns to Heathrow and he sort of steps off the plane with his suntan and a straw donkey clutching a bottle of rum and whistling Una Paloma Blanca.
Una Paloma Blanca.
It's not what they'd call today great optics, John.
It doesn't look great
when your country...
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So I think one of his press secretaries sort of said, you need to just go straight to Downing Street. And then someone else advised him, no, we're going to do a press conference, thinking that would sort of sort it all out, which was possibly the worst decision ever.
After not having the autumn election,
After not having the autumn election. So he holds this press conference all tanned at Heathrow. Yeah. And he starts telling them, you know, what a lovely jolly time he's had. He was swimming in the sea. He tells them and all this.
The rum cocktails.
While his press secretary's going, just shut up, Jim. Stop talking.
It's great. The rum cocktails are brilliant. And this parrot land on my shoulder try them. Is fantastic.
And then when they do ask him about the strikes, he starts getting angry and sort of accusing the media of not loving their country for bringing up the strikes, you know, for sort of whipping up this frenzy, which he sort of got a point, but not now, Jim.
No, not now, Jim.
And then a reporter from the Evening Standard asks him, what is your general approach in view of the mounting chaos in the country at the moment? And he replies, I promise if you look at it from the outside, I don't think other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos. Now, when you've got a country whipped up into a frenzy of shortages and everything else, for your prime minister to say there's no chaos. So the next morning, the front page of The Sun has this famous headline, crisis, what crisis? Which actually, James Callaghan never said those words.
But it's still the title of your book that you read about this.
That's the title of the book about it, is crisis, what crisis? And that's the sort of phrase that is really associated with James Callaghan's premiership.
And it was The Sun who actually came up with the phrase, the winter of discontent. That was Larry Lamb, the editor of The Sun, who called it the winter of discontent. I think after it all happened, actually, and they look back at it and said, what our Sun readers need to do is to quote Shakespeare. I think they're all the beginning of Richard III is what they're all thinking about right now. And that's why. But it's weird that it had such a powerful sort of, it was such a powerful soundbite, the winter of discontent, much more powerful than a 3-day week. And they just sort of won the PR war on this.
It had been sort of tried out before, but hadn't really stuck like it did in 78, 79.
And now when you get a camping shops in December.
Oh, here we go.
They always put, now is the winter of our discount tents.
Yay! Yay!
Hats off to them for that.
So then, of course, these strikes continue to then work their way into the public sector. So
this is really when it gets back serious, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. So nurses went out on strike. Railway men went out. Yeah. Lots of hospitals were only really catering for emergencies now. And then lots of groups of workers start taking unofficial action as well, because they all want a bite of this and go, well, if they can get 20%, I can get, you know, why am I sticking to my 5%?
Basically, the bubble, the dam had burst, didn't it, really? On this sort of, after several years of wage restraint, they're all going, well, if they're not doing it, I'm not doing it. And they're all very low paid workers. It should be said, these people were keeping the country going on low wages. They were paid as greedy and selfish by Thatcher, but they were.
But they're people being paid way under the rate of inflation. You know, it wasn't motivated necessarily by grit. And it was, you know, if they're getting their 17%, I should be getting my 17%, you know, or whatever.
So can I just ask, Angela, around this time, were they able to bury the dead?
Well, John. This is the, I mean, these are the things I think that really start, and it's a bit like in COVID times, you know, these are the things that start really penetrating through to a public consciousness when it starts affecting the NHS and when it starts affecting, so ambulance drivers refuse to attend 999 calls in some areas, the army have to take over.
Again, I've got to say, they did this very reluctantly. They were like, they've been held down, they've been used, the emotional blackmail had been used on them, you know, for years and years about, oh, you can't go on strike. And so they didn't. Mm. And eventually it's like, they're so underpaid that they do this very reluctantly.
Yeah,
like,
I think people forget about the social contract. They forget that they'd, you know, kept their pay low for years up to this point in order to bring down inflation. And it just got to a point where it's like, no, not anymore. The shit really hit the fan when the general municipal workers went out in Liverpool. And the bin men usually were the first to go out, and they requested that they didn't go first this time because it was always them. Let someone else have a go. And so permission was granted for the first time ever for crematoria staff to go out first. And they hadn't striked before. Yeah. So they thought there might be some media backlash, but they didn't quite know
you
what was about to come.
Couldn't even bury the dead. She must have said that 1,000 times, Maggie. I mean, this was the iconic soundbite. When we had rubbish piling in the streets, we couldn't even bury our dead. Like, you didn't actually have any dead to bury, Maggie. But
And also, what did you have dead relatives in Liverpool, Maggie? No, you
I don't
didn't
think
really.
So.
Stop it.
Yeah.
Liverpool City Council had hired a factory to store corpses in until they could be buried. And that thought of that, the thought of unburied bodies, we don't like that, human beings.
There was always there was enough capacity to store and delay these funerals. No one said, and it got to the stage where some funerals were delayed. It was never some funerals are delayed. It's like we couldn't even bury our dead, like they're lying around in the lounge or something. I listened to this interview with this guy, and he said, is there a danger that we're going to have to bury these bodies at sea? No. So you're saying we could bury them at sea? No. Are we going to come to the stage where it's a health hazard? No.
No.
So there we have it. There's a health hazard. We may have to bury them at sea. It's like, it's just ridiculous.
But then you did have some other doctor, like the medical officer of health for Liverpool. He said that burial at sea would be considered, and also said that they were considering allowing the bereaved to dig their own funerals. Graves, like their
ground
own.
Was frozen,
which obviously
anyway.
Was never going to happen. It was,
the ground was frozen.
Exactly.
You couldn't dig anybody.
So the grave diggers, they eventually settled for a 14% rise after a fortnight off the job. So that they were only on strike for 2 weeks, John. I think that's the other thing as well. People think it was a year of bodies piling
lying
up
around.
Over the, it was 2 weeks in Liverpool.
But the bin men were on strike as well. And the images of rubbish in Leicester Square, well, that was really iconic. So you sort of see central London with piles of bins and rats and
I mean, I live in Brighton, John, where we have a bin strike about 3 times a year. We've got one at the moment. So there's piles of rubbish in Brighton at the moment.
I thought you'd arrange for it to be for this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Piles of bins.
So Callaghan, he took these strikes quite personally, because even though it was definitely, you know, by not calling the election and by being adamant about the 5% pay limit, he had to take some responsibility. But he built his career on this connection to the trade unions, and he called the strikes free collective vandalism.
So the other thing I'd say about this is that the Labour Party was split. So the Labour Party now was like, this isn't working. Jim has not been worked right. There's a left and right of the party, which will rip asunder after the election. So he didn't really have the support of his whole cabinet, or the ordinary members was thinking, this is all a bloody disaster.
Yeah, and a split like that could never happen today.
No, so absolutely, very well put.
So the strikes begin to wind down in February. There's been approximately 6 weeks of disruption, which again, to hear people talk about the winter of discontent, you'd think it was 6 months or more. Yeah. In total in 1979, 29,474,000 working days were lost in industrial disputes, compared with 9,306,000 in 1978. So it was, you know.
It was significant. And it should be said that actually the 70s generally had far greater numbers of strike days lost than previous decades.
It was always, I think the average was around 3 or 4 million.
Yeah, and then it was like 13 million, I think, in this decade. And then much greater than France or West Germany as well. So there was a problem. They used to call it the British disease. There was a problem with industrial relations in the UK. But, you know, the solution that's proposed is always that poor people will get paid less. It's never that sort of management somehow, you know, takes less of a slice. But the damage was done, wasn't it?
It was indeed. And you know, the way the media reported and everything, it really helped the Conservatives to disseminate these arguments about the unions and them being out of control and greedy and this narrative that...
You couldn't even bury the dead.
Couldn't even bury the dead, John. Rubbish piling up in the streets. Couldn't even bury the dead. You know, and the newspapers were full of letters to the editor reflecting this public anger with the unions that really obviously served Thatcher well. She'd been calling for the government to declare a state of emergency right from the beginning of January because that would have really fed into her narrative as well.
Yes.
And in a party political broadcast in January, she sat in this small sitting room and she spoke, she said, not as a politician, but as a Briton. John, I can't do the accent. God. You do it better than I do. Knight, I don't propose to use the time to make party political points. I do not think you'd want me to do so. Yeah, the crisis our country faces is too serious for that. You know,
that's bollocks. Rubbish. That is rubbish, Angela. I'm going to have to
it
say
is it. Rubbish. It's
you're
bollocks.
Sort of half
it's
committed bollocks. To it. I don't think you're fully committed to it.
I tried, mate. I really tried. And then I just, I'm no Mike Yarwood. Do you know what I mean? I'm just
it's true. I do not think you would want me to do so.
It's almost like, John, you've spent more time than me watching and obsessing over Margaret Thatcher. Yeah,
she's my anti-mother.
So, in November 78, so at the beginning of the crisis, Labour had a 5 percentage point lead in the polls over the Tories. By February 79, just 4 months later, 3 months later, the Tories were already showing a 20-point lead in the polls.
All right, and this is difficult because the clock is ticking on this government anyway, because you're only allowed to be in Parliament for 5 years.
Had he had that election in October, they could have won. Now, no chance. 28th of March 1979, House of Commons passed the motion of no confidence by one vote.
So Salford Chairman was too ill to attend. There's one Labour MP who was too ill to take part in the vote.
Really?
To prove his point, he died a few days later. Alfred Sherman. Day after Callaghan's 67th birthday. We share a birthday, me and Jim Callaghan. He's exactly 50 years older than me. Well, he's not alive anymore. But yeah, so that was the day after my 17th birthday when the House called that famous no confidence vote. It's really dramatic.
General election on 3rd of May. Thatcher runs under the slogan, Labour isn't working.
You remember that famous poster with them all queuing? They were actually young Conservatives from South Hendon Conservative Party, those people.
God.
And then, so Labour complained about that and it got loads more publicity for the poster. It was shared on the news and everything.
That's
so,
it, the Streisand effect, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, exactly.
Yeah, that. The consequences are we then end up with 18 years of Tory rule and everyone's happy, right, John?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, no one's got any complaints about that, I think. I think, well, listeners will all agree.
Absolutely, I think so. Yeah. So basically, while the beginning of this sort of monetarism is attributed to Callaghan, Thatcher took it and really ran with it.
She really did.
Oh, really saw off that post-war consensus.
She'd read her Milton Friedman and Hayek's Road to Serfdom.
Hey, John, ready for this? They went from Keynes to Milton, which is better than going to Milton
to
Keynes.
Milton Keynes, but I'm...
Hey.
That's the sort of deep political analysis that you really want. What would have happened if there hadn't been an election? I don't think the SDP would have been created. Labour might have held it together if they'd been in power. It would have been Thatcher, wouldn't have been 18 years of Thatcher, as you're saying. Who knows what might have been different? We might have gone a more French route where unions still had a role to play.
I wonder if they had had the election in October but hadn't won, I still wonder if there would have been quite that Gang of Four breakaway that there was.
Yeah, but I just think Thatcherism wouldn't have happened in the same way.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
exactly.
It happened. We had Reaganism in America, so maybe it would, but
neoliberal something or other.
Yes, there might have been some other form, and it might have been Labour doing it. They might have split the party even more. Who knows? But 76 to 79, fascinating period. John gets his hair cut. The pistols split.
I was born.
Angela was born. Amazing time. Very hard to imagine now. Three TV channels, everyone going, oh, TV's ending at 10:30. We'll go to our rooms and read our books. And that's going to use up more power than if we'd stayed in one room.
Do you know what, though, John?
I
sort of wish we'd go back to that because I can't deal with so much choice. I can't deal with it. It's just if somebody said, right, the telly goes off at 10:30, I'd go, brilliant, I'll go and read a book then. Rather than go, I could read a book. I could watch any film that's ever been made. I could listen to any album that's ever been made. I could read any book that's ever... It's too much, John. I can't go.
Then it was just one thing. You watched Blue Peter. Blue Peter actually had a little feature during the Winter of Discontent on how to wrap an old person in newspaper to keep them warm. So it's like John Oakes. No, they did. I read this thing. So the book I read about this was The Winter of Discontent.
As long as they don't smoke, that could have been disastrous.
They all smoked. They all dried their vest over the paraffin heaters. We'd had a fireman strike a couple of years beforehand. I read The Winter of Discontent, Myth, Memory and History by Tara Martin Lopez. And I think the myth thing is what's really interesting for me, because it was a big deal for a few weeks and there was rubbish piled up in the streets. And there were power cuts, and there were heating, and there was, you know, picket lines. But it was nothing like what we've just had with COVID. It was nothing like 200,000 people dying and the government are on 40% in the polls. And it's like, because of who controls sort of, you know, the national discourse.
The COVID report's come out today, hasn't it, as we're talking today. And how... that doesn't make a prime minister resign. When you see what prime ministers resigned over in the past, it blows my mind.
You know, if you had a Labour government sitting over this crisis, it would have been absolutely ripped apart. Mm. But Johnson just gets away with anything. It drives me crazy, Angela, even from here in my luxury apartment in New York. I'm doing a musical. I'm so cross about what's happening in Britain. I'm thinking of never coming back like Andrew Lloyd Webber. Have I lost some credibility? Is my argument dying in my mouth here? I think it's a fascinating example of myth, the power of myth and narrative.
It really is. And just how you can make, you know, collective memory is a thing, and how you can actually, a whole nation can misremember.
Yeah. I mean, it was a crisis, but it wasn't as bad as the 3-day week in terms of, you know, lights out and power strikes and, you know, affecting the everyday work. But somehow it's become this terrible thing, which we must never go back to. And Thatcher went about it all the way through the 80s and even into the 90s. So even when Blair was standing in 97, it's like, I think if you look back at the last Labour government, come on, that was a generation ago now.
It was,
you
know, 6 weeks in a generation ago. Let it go, Maggie.
Let it go, guys. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I think John's ranted enough from a fairly weak position, let's admit.
Thank you to everyone that sort of in our little hiatus tweeted us and kept in touch.
Please come back. And
don't forget, you can tweet us at We Are History Pod. And also, we're hoping, now we haven't actually organised anything yet, but if there's like an appetite for it, I think we might try and do some live shows next year, mightn't we, John? Some live.
Hello, Nebworth.
Do give us a follow. Do all that.
Five stars,
reviewing and five stars and stuff, because that helps. If you haven't actually subscribed, please do that, because that
and downloads automatically. Yeah.
Yes. Bye.